My brief for today was to round up the talks on the refuge tree. That's really difficult. How do you sum it up? We've been talking about this for a year. There's all these figures, these historical figures, these sort of archetypal figures on the refuge tree. There's things we haven't even talked about yet. There's Dharma books on the refuge tree. It's a whole sort of, there's these other branches that we just haven't looked at. So all the Dharma, all the Sangha. Sum that up, you've got 40 minutes. All those different traditions that we've looked at, all those different traditions and how they feed into us, all those different Dharma teachings, how they feed into us. I did have a plan, which I was to say, I'm not going to talk about any of that. I'm going to talk about the five precepts. let's get back to basics here. Apart from anything else, the refuge tree is a very strange and funny thing. I'm sure there are people here who, when I say refuge tree, they think, what is he on about? Absolutely, what is that? It's an iconic, iconographic representation of, if you like, the people who've contributed to our lineage, the sort of people that we look to as having contributed to the sort of Dharma we teach. And that's what is on that shrine there. Here's another way. Say Tibetan traditions have got such a refuge tree. There's another one. Look, it's a tree. It's a different lineage. It's got Tara at the middle, and it's got leaves and trunks and things. It's a way of representing how the lineages come down to us, and it's quite a common sort of idea. But it's still a pretty strange thing, and I know a lot of people, because they've told me, either they're lying and buttering me up, but I don't think so. I know a lot of people have got a lot out of this series. But how to sum it up? What graspable nugget can I point you towards that you could take away from this year-long series on the refuge tree? And maybe the point is that the nugget can't be grasped. There isn't a graspable nugget. The refuge tree is a symbol, if you like. It's a symbol. It sort of points to something beyond itself, and it speaks of what we might call a myth. We'll go into this a little bit more. And symbols and myths speak to us at quite a deep level. But we can't sum up their meaning in a nice little intellectual formula. So Sangharakshita talks about the realm of undefined meaning. What does that mean? I don't know, but he says the symbol and myth, they exist in the realm of undefined meaning. We can't quite pin them down. They've got terrific meaning, but it can't be reduced to something we can immediately grasp. I link that in my own mind with something I heard somebody say in a talk at Padmaloka, which is all the most important things in life are too deep for words. Yeah? It's like if we could just sum it up in a nice little formula. Well, it'd be trite. But actually, the really deep things that drive us are too deep for words. While I was racking my brains as to what I could possibly say to sum up this evening, I came across a booklet by an order member called Arlika, who's also an artist, called The Refuge Tree as Mythic Context. And in that, so he's looking at the refuge tree as what he calls mythic context. And in that, he goes into this whole subject of myth. What on earth do we mean by myth? So, a lot of us, what myth means, a story that's not true. Or it means some funny sort of story about gods and goddesses cavorting around and, that sort of thing. Because that's the sort of, in a way, that's the level at which it's been presented to us. That's not what we really mean by myth. Myths are the deep realities underlying things. The deep realities underlying this apparently sort of ordinary and humdrum world that we live in. their deep meanings underneath things that act, that sometimes surface like whales into this world and give meaning and colour and vibrancy to what we're doing. It's a realm, it's a sort of connection with a realm of deep meaning. So they're not nice stories that aren't true. They are the reality. If we see the universe and the world as humdrum and grey, that's not the reality. The reality is the myths. The reality is the myths behind it. And living more in that sort of mythic realm makes these moments when the sort of the back of the whale of something beyond breaks the surface, it makes that much more common. It merges our everyday life with a deeper meaning and makes it much more meaningful rather than tedious. So talking another way, if you like, we could say a myth is a story that brings out the underlying significance of life. But that significance isn't a meaning in the narrow intellectual sense of the word. It's something beyond scientific truth. It's something beyond ordinary wordy concepts. It's beyond something beyond the utilitarian. Life can't be understood in the narrow sense. Yeah? The purpose of life cannot be understood in that narrow sense. You can't say the purpose of life is this. So myth can't be understood in that narrow sense. Life is a mystery. The purpose of life is a mystery. So the purpose of life can only be understood within a mythic context that speaks to a person at a deep level. So, I mean, people have, in the past, people have always lived by myth. They live out a mythic, they live within a mythic context. For many, many generations, people lived within the mythic context of Christianity. The mythic context of the suffering saviour. Or the context of, you know, uniting with Christ after death, that sort of thing. There's a whole myth that people lived out of that. Others lived the sort of myth of the knight, the myth of the chivalric warrior, fighting for the good, noble and fighting for the good. King Arthur and his knights, the round table, this group of questing sort of individuals, the Holy Grail, all of that. And then Christianity had loads of subsidiary myths, the saints, all of that. The myth of St. Francis, living the Franciscan life, the sort of life of complete simplicity, of love of all things, as a wandering friar, a wandering poor friar. Potent myth, a really potent myth that a lot of people live by. The myth of the poet, the bard, the myth of the artist, the healer, the heroic quester. There's, you know, people live out these myths. I mean, today, well, all our myths have been like, you know, rubbed out. We don't have them anymore. They're all discredited. So people have to take part in fantasy games to get some sort of echo of what it might be like to live a bit more mythically. Yes, I mean, quote, one of the things that Arlecca says in his little booklet is human beings cannot afford to ignore the realm of the mythic. A human being without a mythic context is a contextless human being. And a contextless human being is a prey to the demons of anxiety, fear, insecurity, and lack of confidence. That's what he says. So a contextless human being is prey to the demons of anxiety, fear, insecurity, and lack of confidence. And those are all symptoms of a lack of real significance in our lives. If we don't have real significance in our lives, we will experience loads of anxiety, loads of fear, loads of insecurity, and we won't be confident. And they're all really common problems in our sort of myth-free, contextless modern world. Because many people are contextless. Many people have no mythic context for their life, no deeper sense of meaning for their life. And without that mythic context, it's pretty impossible for a human being to experience themselves in their fullness, to access their full depths, and to access our full depths and our full resources. We just won't do that if we don't have some sort of deep significance in our lives, which goes a bit beyond the intellectual. We tend to stay shallow and superficial. So connecting with a mythic context is a way to realize that there's a lot more to human life than is usually believed. It's a way of connecting with the fact that there's a lot more to us than we usually believe. There are depths in us that we don't usually contact. And it's a way of experiencing an awful lot more meaning in the present moment. Like this moment. This moment is an expression of something timeless, of something beyond the normal world. If we can connect with our own motivating symbols and myths, we sort of activate ourselves. We sort of plug ourselves into something way beyond ourselves. We bring our own energy and our resources and our vividness on tap. We get inspired, we wake up. And we need all that to make our Dharma practice effective. We're not going to get enlightened with the top 3 inches of our head. We're going to get enlightened with our whole being, which includes our whole body and our depths. We're going to need to bring all of that into it. There's a quote here from a guy called Bruno Bettelheim, terrific name, he's a psychoanalyst. He wrote a book called The Uses of Fascination, which is all about this. It's about fairy stories, actually, fairy stories and myths. The Uses of Fascination. So he's talking about how these serve a purpose, how they put us in touch with deep meaning. And he says, if we hope to live not just from moment to moment, but in true consciousness of our existence, then our greatest need and most difficult achievement is to find a meaning in our lives. An understanding of the meaning of one's life is not suddenly acquired at a particular age, and it has nothing to do with chronological maturity. On the contrary, finding a secure understanding of the meaning of one's life, this is what constitutes psychological maturity. So he's saying we don't achieve psychological maturity until we've connected with some sort of deep context for ourselves, deep meaning. So that is a life's work. You know, it's not. That's the most significant thing we can do our life, with our life. And in the refuge tree, we're introduced, if you like, we're introduced to a rich mythic world. Whose meaning can't be pinned down. But that does raise the question of what sort of myth it represents. So what sort of myth does it represent? So Alaka, in his little book, says it represents the myth of the cosmic drama of enlightenment, or the myth of the bodhisattva's activity, unfolding through eternity and providing a context for us to live meaningfully. Does that mean anything? Okay. The cosmic drama of enlightenment. So what I understand him to be saying is it's a myth about something outside time and space as we normally understand it, manifesting in this world that we live in a way that influences all these different people and in a way that brings the lineage down to us. It's about something manifesting from outside. It's a bit like we're in the Matrix, we're in the computer game, and something's sort of sending messages to us from outside the computer game, saying, wake up! You know? And those messages are sort of summed up in the refuge tree. They're either people who've, people who've got some deep significance from outside, or teachings, etc., etc. So, something from outside time manifesting in time in a way that's come down to us. So at the very top of the refuge tree, we've got Vajrasattva, right? Vajrasattva representing, if you like, the enlightened mind outside of space and time, the Dharmakaya, reality trying to get through to us the absolute. So you got that at the very, very top. And then this absolute, because we're part of it, actually, it's actually not separate from us. It's constantly trying to get through to us. So like, come on, wake up. Wake up, you lot. You know. So the absolute's constantly trying to get through to us, seeking to express itself in this realm that we live in. Trying to get through to us beings trapped in this prison of temporal existence, us poor things trapped in this matrix, this computer game. Yeah, come on, wake up, it's only a game. Wake up. So it's manifesting. There's this something from outside the realm we live in manifesting. And it's manifesting imperfectly all the time. It's manifesting imperfectly in the lives of all these people that we've looked at, all these wacky black magicians and rebels and spiritual geniuses and heroes and so on that we've looked at on the refuge street. It's manifesting in them, but imperfectly, because they're human beings trapped in time. It's manifesting in those people, as we say in the puja, so that life in this world may not grow dark. Yeah? Without this, without this something that's manifesting through this, life in this world would just be dark. It would just be, we'd be stuck. It's like we're in a darkened room and this is the light that's coming in. So it's not, you know, these non-perfect, these flawed human beings are, but something is manifesting through them. Something is manifesting through them. The universe is shining through them for the good of the universe. Something to do with that. Incidentally, I'm wallowing here. I'm thinking out loud, but don't mind. It's enlightenment trying to manifest as much as it can. Through those figures, through those flawed people, through the Dharma books, trying to express itself, always imperfectly through all these Dharma books, saying it in different ways. And trying to doing it directly into our minds sometimes, you know, sort of like we're in meditation, it suddenly sort of pops up into our mind in the form of Manjugosha, whoa, or something. Vajrapani, one of the family protectors. So, and coming down to us, this stream of spiritual energy. This is why we called this series the Stream of Gold, right? After we called it the Stream of Gold, we got rather cold feet about that because we thought, well, some people might take this as a bit, you know, a slightly strange allusion to something unwholesome. But if you forget about the possibility of that, it's like a stream of gold coming down to us. It's a stream of spiritual energy, a stream of light, a stream of something, you know, really tremendous, coming down to us through all these figures, through these Dharma books, until it manifests in the lives of even, you know, me and this Buddhist center, and what goes on here, and the Buddhists we know, and this very imperfect Sangha that supports us, and these rather weird order members that run this place, and, you know, so on and so forth. So it's something, it's this stream of gold coming down to us. And then us, you know, it doesn't stop with us being part of that myth, not just passive receivers, but in our own way being very imperfect transmitters of this stream of spiritual energy. Expressing it and passing it on so that life in this world may not grow dark. So Sangharakshita expressed this very well in something he said. He was asked by somebody how he had come to found a new Buddhist movement in the West. Why did you found a new Buddhist movement in the West and how did you do it? And he said that he didn't feel as though he had founded it. He felt as though something huge and mysterious and overarching had founded it through him. Something had used him to found it, despite his faults. He said it almost got founded despite him. It was something that wanted to come into existence, and it did. So, something mysterious and overarching that worked through him, is how he saw it. And he thought he was a really unsuitable person to found a new Buddhist movement. But that it had happened, despite him. And I think in a lesser way, maybe that's how quite a few order members feel, actually. When I think about this place, I think, how did we get this together? I don't know, I couldn't have done it. It's just, you know, it's just like, it seems a bit of a miracle. It seems like something's going on. Something important is going on here, and we're privileged to be part of it. We're privileged to let it use us, in a way. And it becomes our practice then to deal with our own stupid flaws and our own inadequacies so that we don't get in the way too much. So that it can use us. So that we can be better vehicles for this sort of spiritual energy, if you like. And maybe that's what it means to live with the refuge tree as a mythic context. Or whatever the refuge tree represents. I mean, it's a refuge tree because we go for refuge to it. We go for refuge to it, which means we make it our meaning. We make it our mythic context. It becomes the meaning that drives our lives. And obviously that's not about that silly painting. It's about something much bigger than that. It is about something, some stream of spiritual energy manifesting that we seem to have somehow, by some unimaginable lucky quirk, be on the receiving end of. And what would life be like if we weren't on the receiving end of it? It'd be horrible. So maybe that's what it means to live with the refuge tree as a mystic context, and maybe that's also what it means a little bit to go for refuge. It means to really live out that mythic context. And if we can see it like that, if we can go for refuge like that, then suddenly life has got a lot more meaning in it. Suddenly life's got loads more meaning. So this Buddhist centre then isn't just a stone building. In a rather run-down post-industrial city, in a rather decadent country that's had its prime and is now on its way down. It's something magical and mythic, manifesting from another realm. It's a form in which an amazing stream of spiritual energy is manifesting even to us, even in the midst of the madness of 21st century Britain. Here it is. And this imperfect Sangha, this Dharma we haltingly teach, these weird order members with all their flaws and strangenesses, it's all vivid with meaning. It's all vivid with meaning. It's worth putting yourself on the line for. It's worth growing and developing for. It's worth putting your silly personal feelings and likes and dislikes to one side for. So it becomes a real source of something. It's more than a bit miraculous. If you can see it that way, it all becomes more than a bit miraculous. This stream of spiritual energy has come down even to me. I often think this, like, this really occurs to me on retreat. I find myself in a room with these amazing people. So it happens to me on Mitra Kuvina's retreats particularly, because I find myself in a room with these people and I think, when I was a lot younger, I couldn't have imagined my life being this good. I just couldn't have imagined it. I couldn't have imagined I would be in the same room with people as this caliber, talking about things like this, in this way. I just couldn't have imagined it. I couldn't have imagined the life I currently live. The people I know, the things I do, what have I done to deserve it? It's a miracle. It's a miracle. This has come down even to me. This stream of gold, you know. And I'd say that one of my responses to that is one of gratitude, is one of a sense of gratitude. All these great figures on the refuge tree, the lifetime's work of Sangharakshita in founding the FWBO, so many order members who've put all their time and effort and energy and talents into building what we've got. The people who've put, people have given their lives to help the FWBO get to where it is now. People who've given a lot of their lives to this centre, including Yaman and Mogavangsa over there, without which this wouldn't be here. What sort of person would I be if I just let it stop there and said, thank you very much, and now I don't want to pass it on. Thank you very much, that's very nice. I've benefited from that, and I'm not going to do anything about it to carry on that tradition. What would I be? I would be churlish. So this gratitude, this sense of wanting to contribute, wanting to be part of that stream of energy, it fights with my egotism, it fights with my self-obsession, it fights with my insecurity, my desire to get my own way, but it's still there, you know, it's still there, sort of pushing me along. It's part of that mythic context. There's still that sense of gratitude and a desire to contribute to the universe, to be part of that stream of energy and not just a consumer of it, not just a passive consumer of it. So maybe that's got something to do with what's at the heart of the refuge tree. If you look at the refuge tree spatially, it depends a little bit on how you orientate it, but what do you think is at the very heart of the refuge tree? That image of the refuge tree. The Buddha, okay? And if you think of the Buddha, what's like the central thing that you might sort of, he's around. What's, you know, if you just look at him spatially, what you look at the center of that, what would you see? The bowl. You've got it. The begging bowl. The begging bowl. So, in a way, the begging bowl is at the very center. The Buddha's begging bowl is at the very center of the refuge tree. If we're going to look at one nugget. And the Buddha's begging bowl is often sort of held out as a symbol of renunciation. But I think that's a bit sort of negative, really. It's not so much a symbol of renunciation. It's a symbol of complete dependency on others. Our complete dependency on others. All the good things come to us from the work of others. We are in the position of beggars. We're in the position of beggars. Entirely supported by others. So in the spiritual sphere, all those figures on the refuge tree, all those order members I've talked about, all the people that have contributed, the people who give dana to this centre, the people who help in any number of ways, the sangha that all sort of keeps it all together. We owe all of them. On the receiving end of all of that. We're on the receiving end of all the efforts of all the people who created this as a reasonably free and society in which we can have the leisure and ability to practice. Mad as the uses to which that freedom and leisure is put by most people in this society, we can benefit from it. This sangha, our friends and supporters, the people who set up the basis in Sheffield, just everything, just, you know, we are on the receiving end of all of that. We're on the receiving end of all of that. We are in the position of beggars. We rely on other people's dana. We rely on other people's generosity. There's a Dasa Dhamma Sutta. There's a sutta called the Dasa Dhamma Sutta, which is 10 contemplations for the monk in the Pali Canon. The first of these contemplations is, I exist entirely on the generosity of others. Well, they were monks, they begged, the begging bowl. I exist entirely on the generosity of others. My life depends on the generosity of others. That was their the first contemplation in this list of 10. I live entirely by the donations of others, and unless I see my practice as being about the benefits, the way I can benefit others, I am churlish. And that was a constant theme for the Buddha. It was a constant theme that the Buddha went on about. Practice for the welfare of the many, for the well-being of gods and men. It's the many that support you, you're beggars. Practice for their benefit, unless you want to be the worst sort of churlish, selfish individual. And we exist by the benefit of the many of the past and also the many of the present. We're in exactly the same position. So he was saying to his monks, and I think it's true of us, your very existence depends on the goodwill and generosity of others. Live and practice and repay it out of gratitude. Be part of that web of generosity. That web of generosity is the mythic context. It's something manifesting. It's something beyond sort of individual's egotism manifesting in the world. It's the bodhicitta manifesting in the world, if you want to look at it that way. It's the enlightened mind manifesting in the world. Be part of that web of generosity. Or, but you're not. Or you're not part of the mythic context. So don't consume the alms food of the country in vain. That's something the Buddha often said. You know, if you don't practice, you're consuming the alms food of the people in vain. You're wasting their alms food. Go and do some work. You know, go and earn your pay if you're not going to practice for the well-being of the many. Be worthy of the alms food. And this just really contrasts, doesn't it, with the sort of strident insistence on rights that we often come across. The sort of failure to see that what we get actually comes from the work and well-being of others. Which is refusal to accept that we're on the receiving end of generosity, which is just ego, 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 me, me, me. So we are on the receiving end of this stream of spiritual power, comes down to us, this stream of gold. And at the very centre of the symbol of this stream of spiritual power is the begging bowl, the symbol of our complete dependency on others, our debt to others, and of the fact that gratitude and generosity is the only decent response, a sort of lifestyle where we see ourselves as being about contributing and passing this on, rather than letting it stop with us. A gratitude for the privileged position that we find ourselves in. So that's what I think is the crux of the refuge tree, because we are in an incredibly privileged position. What, you know, how often has a meeting like this been possible? You know, we've got that leisure, opportunity, access to the Dharma. We don't have to spend our lives in grinding poverty. We're not in a totalitarian state. We don't have to toe the line. It's amazing. It's amazing. We're in such a privileged position. And the response to that, the very centre of the refuge tree, is that symbol of gratitude. To me. So that's what, if I have to come up with a nugget to take away from the refuge tree, that's what I would take away. It's amazing. How did I find myself in this position? I must do something to pass it on and repay it.